The Guardian.
Lights, camera, action. But where was the drama when Boris met Jeremy? I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly. With just over 3 weeks to go until polling day, around 7 million viewers tuned in as Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn took to what looked like the set for a hectic daytime quiz show for their first televised election debate. ITV's Julie Etchingham seemed as fed up as some of the viewers at times as she tried to get straight answers out of the leaders of the two main parties. Easier said than done. Corbyn was quickly criticised for resolutely not answering which way he would campaign in a second Brexit referendum on a Labour deal, despite Johnson's best efforts. Meanwhile, on Twitter, the Conservative Party saw a real-time backlash for deciding to rename their main media account Fact Check UK and using it to pump out anti-Corbyn propaganda and declare Boris Johnson the clear winner. But for most people who tuned in, it was anything but a clear winner. So does the sniggering we heard from the audience last night show voters find the whole idea of either leader laughable? And did the lacklustre performance work in favour of any of the smaller parties? Plus, the Greens kicked off manifesto week yesterday, soon to be followed by the Lib Dems, then Labour, and eventually the Conservatives. Given that we've heard so many policy promises already, what should we expect to see on paper, and do the manifestos matter? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, you might have noticed that you haven't heard my colleague Rowena Mason presenting the show recently. Well, that's because in order to follow what the campaigns are getting up to day to day, my little team has been shipped all over the UK, meaning we've barely clapped eyes on each other. For example, today, Rowena is on the Tory battle bus as it travels from Manchester to a string of Labour-held seats in the north. I caught up with her earlier to hear what the mood is like the day after the first debate, as well as just getting to know more about what life is like on a campaign battle bus.
Well, this is the first day that Boris Johnson has taken out a pack of journalists along with him on those buses that are emblazoned and Get Brexit Done. There's two of them, one containing all the broadcasters and one containing all the print hacks. And everybody's following him round. He's going to a load of different businesses and going for target seats, really Labour-held target seats, where he thinks he's got a chance of winning. At the moment, we're in Sedgefield, which is the former seat of Tony Blair, and it would seem quite a long shot to overturn that, but he's here about to give a speech to some, a factory tour, in fact, and a speech to some workers.
And how tightly controlled is it, Rowena? Do you get to wander up and say hello to the Prime Minister?
It's extremely tightly controlled. I mean, it was ever thus in a way. All the Tory Prime Ministers have been like this, in that they want events held at friendly premises where workers are basically only going to be asking questions in front of their bosses. In general, it's a very tightly controlled event. Members of the public won't be allowed anywhere near him. It's something that the Conservative minders are very mindful of. They want to keep him on the straight and narrow. They don't want any embarrassing gaffes. And so they keep him to places where they think he's not going to get into trouble.
And not meet too many actual voters by the sound of it. How different is it, Rowena? I remember you were on the Vote Leave bus quite a bit in the 2016 Brexit referendum. I seem to remember at that time there was a lot of talk about the fact that Boris Johnson was quite good at getting off the bus and you know, getting in among people and talking to voters.
It's incredibly different from that. In the Vote Leave campaign, he was constantly walking down the street and he'd have people coming up to him wanting selfies with them, and he was interacting with them a lot. I remember him trying to steal people's ice creams to take a lick of them on the seafront in some seaside town in the east of England. He was absolutely in his element then, and he was enjoying the sort of adulation that he was getting. Since he'd become Prime Minister, he's not been able to go out and interact with the public because his minders are keeping him under a much tighter leash, really. So it's a very different environment for him, and certainly lots of the people who talk to candidates who've been out door knocking are saying that they're not finding any enthusiasm for him, particularly on the doorstep.
And how does he seem, Rowena? I don't know how close you managed to get to him, but I vividly remember a trip on Theresa May's bus quite late in the 2017 campaign where they really knew that it wasn't going terribly well. And she was awkward anyway, but she seemed terribly sort of downhearted. Does he seem like someone who thinks he's going to secure that majority and get himself another 5 years in power?
I mean, there is a sort of arrogant natural confidence about him that I think there's a lot of the advisers do presume that they are going to win, but they're outwardly being very cautious and saying, well, we remember the bitter experience of 2017 so well, where they thought they were going to win and then they fell short of a majority. So they're trying not to appear overconfident, but the vibe that you get off them is that they do think that they're going to do very well.
Rowena, I have hopes that you might eventually be able to present Politics Weekly at some point during the campaign. Maybe next week it will be me out on the bus and you behind the mic.
I would love to escape the Tory bus and come back and present Politics Weekly. But I'm hoping that next Wednesday will be free and I'll be back in the chair.
Fingers crossed. Rowena, thanks very much. That was The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason, who's currently somewhere en route to a Labour seat in the north. But back in the studio, I'm joined by former Labour advisor and Standard columnist Aisha Hazarika, former press secretary to Theresa May, Paul Harrison, and professor of politics at the University of Southampton, Will Jennings. Paul, do you remember what life was like on the battle bus in 2017?
I do. I spent a bit of time on the battle bus. Like a lot of the rest of the campaign, it wasn't necessarily my most enjoyable period of life, but one thing that I learned through bitter experience, right, and this is a completely useless tip, don't sit anywhere near the printer, because when you need to print something to give the boss, it will break. That is the law. It is ordained. And whoever was most proximate to it at the time that something needs to be printed previously is going to be the person who's going to be blamed for having broken it. So
that is an important campaign tip there. And well, in 2017, it didn't really come off, did it? As in, Theresa May visited a lot of those constituencies the Tories hoped to take. They didn't take very many in the end. Is it plausible this time that Boris Johnson could break through that red wall, as some people have called it, that he could take seats like Sedgefield?
Well, I think in 2017, the problem obviously was that you do the planning at the start of the campaign and then suddenly vote intentions shift and you find that you're in the wrong place. So we don't really know. I mean, I think there are issues around those sorts of Labour leave voting seats this time that might make them in play. It's very clear that Boris Johnson has started to kind of soak up some of the Brexit Party, a lot of the Brexit Party vote. So that's why the Conservatives have some confidence in those sorts of areas this time. You know, the Conservatives have to do is make Brexit the defining issue in those seats to turn those Leave voters. And what Corbyn and Labour will try and do is try and get those voters thinking about the NHS, austerity, inequality, and all the issues that we heard about the debate last night. So it really is a battle between the parties to try and prime voters to think about different sorts of issues.
Yeah, that's the campaign right there.
That's the campaign right there. I feel like we're sort of waiting, maybe it's just me, but I feel like we're waiting for the moment when the campaign kind of catches fire and people kind of tune in and get interested. Was the debate last night, was that it?
Not really. I mean, this has been quite a lackluster campaign. This election's funny. It's like, you know, nobody, everyone said they wanted it, but actually when push came to shove, nobody really, really wants, like that third child, nobody really, really wants it. And so what I think is really interesting is that, like, the leaders' debates, whether you love them or loathe them, strategists will be using them to punctuate the campaign. It gives them a frame. And when you're plotting a grid, you know, one week you can be health, one week you can be Brexit, one week you can be education. But it's quite hard to actually find content and events to keep the public interest and the national media interest very high. So I think these leaders' debates do provide, it provides quite a useful strategic framework. The reason why the campaign hasn't really come alive is because nobody has made a huge gaffe yet. There has not been one of those cut-through moments, whether it's, you know, Theresa May starting to tank the social care stuff, Mrs. Duffy. There hasn't been that kind of moment where everyone's like, oh my goodness, I can't believe this has happened. And they're often, election campaigns are not defined by hugely positive moments. They're defined by big mistakes that different parties leaders. And I think both sides have been playing it quite safe so far. Labour probably had the best cut through with the broadband policy, which was announced, partly because, you know, whether you loved it or hated it, people were talking about it a lot. But I think the debate last night has kind of enlivened things a wee bit until somebody makes some catastrophe, I think people are going to be a bit bored.
And no, there wasn't one, Will, was there? There wasn't a moment last night, or I didn't spot one, where somebody really messed up or somebody, you know, caught the mood of the audience and won in any way.
No, I mean, it was painful to watch at times, and the audience weren't having truck with certain things. They laughed at both leaders.
Yeah, what did you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think it just show. I mean, I think there is an issue around these or the audiences who turn up to these debates. It actually was noticeable as the night went on. They became more kind of almost became like a kind of a some sort of kind of competition between the support different supporters in the audience of both sides. So you would get, you know, kind of Corbyn being jeered and then Johnson being laughed at. And so actually, I do actually think that the audience in those events actually really undermines the quality of the interaction between the candidates, because, you know, we kind of hear this kind of boo hiss type style of politics. But I think the truth is that, you know, from the audience and the general public, there's a huge degree of cynicism. And that's why actually some of the very big signature policy issues that are getting rolled out by both parties, people don't really trust the parties. They're cynical about the kind of the goodies on offer. And so actually that's why it's really difficult for either party to cut through. And I don't think, you know, they really interact with each other. They speak past each other during those sorts of debates.
I do agree with that. But I do think for us in the bubble, who, I mean, our job is to pour over this stuff, you know, you say, look, he talked about Brexit, Corbyn talked about the NHS. I mean, they would do. But for quite a lot of people that did tune in, they're not going to be as au fait as we are with the codes that these men send off.
The lines aren't going to sound as tired either.
Yeah,
I guess.
And I think actually the audience viewing figures were no bad for last night. You know, they were kind of over 6.5 million. So everybody that tuned in is not going to be a political nerd like us. And it probably was quite interesting for people to see, right, these are the battle lines. And I do agree with you. I've been out door knocking in the last week in different parts of the country, and I'm really surprised. Brexit has hardly featured at all. Schools and hospitals are the top issues that are coming up on the doorstep. And I think a lot of this is going to come down to turnout as well. So even though the polls have got Boris Johnson ahead at the moment, I know that Jeremy Corbyn's personal ratings are still pretty dire, I'm still kind of sceptical. I think it's still really close to call.
Well, turnout's going to be quite important, isn't it?
Well, I think, just building on that, I think one thing that I am finding it really hard to square is that we know that the Conservative vote is increasingly Leave-dominated. We know also Leave voters were less likely to turn out in 2017. They're the sorts of voters that are actually less likely to turn out in general elections. So actually, it's fascinating, A, to see the very big Conservative leads in the polls. And so it starts the question of, will these people turn out, right? And I don't think we know. And it's a very strange circumstance where Remainers seem actually more activated around the issue of Brexit. So again, this speaks to this kind of... It's not straightforward to go into those Leave voting northern towns and say vote on Brexit and everything, forget everything else. And obviously the Conservatives have been trying to push other issues, you know, addressing kind of towns, you know, decline of, you know, kind of large, you know, regional inequality. But I think turnout is going to be a huge issue. The party's mobilisation, we could see a low turnout election compared to last time, where actually the party's operations are really key. And I think we just don't know how postal voting is going to turn out. I think, you know, someone who's involved in the exit poll, where we model on the day change in the vote, I'm a little bit anxious that, you know, if patterns of postal voting change, we're going to have to be really careful about the sorts of kind of changes we see, and that because that really relies on the party's operation. There are some constituencies where the parties have really good postal vote operations. They're often targeted at older voters. So actually, the things that we're thinking may matter at the end of the campaign, people may have well long since voted.
And I think the big challenge that Tories have to do, which is, you know, steal these disaffected Labour voters who are Leave voters. Remember, if the Brexit Party does stand in those areas, a lot of MPs are saying to me that when they're door knocking, yes, there is a lot of frustration, particularly with Jeremy Corbyn. That is definitely an issue. But these voters also don't like what Boris Johnson stands for. They don't like that old Etonian Bullingdon Club, real kind of privilege. And if the Brexit Party stands, that gives them a destination point to go to, which means they don't have to vote Labour, but they don't have to cross quite a heretic line for a lot of people. If your mum and dad and your grandparents and your community have always been quite anti-Tory, you're not voting for a kind of a working class made good Tory. You're voting for kind of the elite sort of Tory. So I see that that is a big threat for Labour, but I'm still sceptical as to how many of those voters the Tories can win.
Do you think that's right, Paul?
Well, there is a remarkable similarity between the kind of overall strategic objective of the 2017 campaign and the campaign now. So it's impossible to tell in a completely new political context where there is actually a deal on the table and where Parliament has been in some way seen to be obstructive. But you are essentially trying to, if you're the Tories, turn this into a single issue based campaign where you say, lend us your vote just this once, chaps, and we'll get this thing that you care about, Brexit, sorted for you. There's certainly more to the campaign than Brexit, but the Tory campaign doesn't work without Brexit. And, you know, so you're saying do Brexit and lend us your vote to do Brexit, and then we can do some other stuff that you also care about. But I think one is probably more important than the other.
Yeah, and it's Brexit on the side of the bus, not the NHS.
Absolutely. And I think also what the Tories are up against is this sort of full-fat Corbynism in terms of, I mean, policy after policy after policy. I mean, in the campaigns that I've worked on before, you would maybe outline throughout an entire campaign maybe sort of 10 pretty big policies, of which maybe two or three would really, really cut through in terms of big ticket spending.
Yeah.
But it's like confetti of sort of policy. But that's quite hard for the Conservatives as well, because their stuff is not, it's not possible for it to sound as eye-catching as the Labour stuff, because the Labour stuff is so big. And I think trust on domestic issues is going to be a problem for the Conservative Party. Of course, the 40 hospitals, which got reduced to 6, and then Jen Williams of the Manchester Evening News was tweeting furiously that this is now all, the funding is called seed funding.
Yeah, that was
now,
the phrase Boris Johnson used last night, I noticed.
Which is not exactly confidence-inspiring. So I do think that, you know, just as the Tories are much stronger on Brexit, Labour is much stronger on a really instinctive level on the domestic stuff.
And I guess that's why they'll both be happy after last night, yes, really, because Corbyn will think, I got a good hit on talking about the NHS and trade deals. You know, the idea that the NHS might be on the table, which obviously the Conservatives pretty vehemently deny and would be mad to do. I mean, it's never going to happen. And then Prime Minister got to mention Brexit a lot, so they'll both be relatively happy. I wonder if what is slightly more significant is what the audience chose to laugh at each of them about. So with Corbyn, it was essentially, I don't know what the word is for his Brexit position, the vagueness perhaps of his Brexit position.
Constructive ambiguity, I think, is probably the...
I think we move beyond constructive ambiguity.
What do we call it now?
I mean, some people have said it's a very clear position. I think the issue around the Brexit position is it's not ambiguous, it's just sitting on the fence. But I do think this issue around spending, I think, is interesting, because I think we've moved to a world where basically, partly because of distrust of voters, the parties can make any sort of promises. They are making all manner of promises. And so you've got this kind of arms race of spending promises. I think it really undercuts one of the historical strengths of Conservative campaigns, which is about fiscal prudence, is that once you've started to really dole out the cash, you actually can't, you know, have a go at John McDonnell and say, oh, you're going to bankrupt the country, because, you know, people are thinking, well, just as money, there's this money tree everywhere. So I think that's a real issue. But, I mean, last night we saw that the audience laughed at Corbyn on Brexit, but they laughed on Johnson on trust, right?
Yeah, I mean,
and kind
that's
of
exactly
telling
what
the truth. And
say,
actually, I was
yeah.
surprised how soft Corbyn was on that. I think, you know, kind of...
On Johnson's sort of character.
Integrity. I mean, I think there's, you know, real issues. And I actually think it was actually quite a mild-mannered debate in terms of the interaction yeah. between the two, that I think, you know, Labour could go a lot harder on, you know, the fact that, you know, Johnson's been sacked from previous jobs before for telling fibs. And I think, you know, there are kind of character issues with both.
Although Corbyn's line is always, we don't do personal, isn't it? He doesn't like doing it. He feels uncomfortable doing it. But should he be doing it, Aisha? Would you be advising him to do it?
Well, I think he should. I mean, I agree with that. I've written a column today in the Evening Standard about that. I do think that they both played it very, very defensively. But in order for any of them to make gains, I'm afraid politics is a bit of a blood sport, and blood is going to have to get drawn. I mean, what makes a debate come alive is actually when you give both opponents the space to sort of attack each other, because it will have to get a bit nasty, and it will have to get a bit personal, and it will have to get to character and to reputation and the brand of both men. And both sides have got plenty of ammunition, and I think
plenty to lose. Though
they've both got a lot to lose, but I think then one of them is going to have to break ranks. I cannot see Boris Johnson going into another debate and not being much more brutal with Jeremy Corbyn. I was speaking to some of my colleagues this morning, who we all worked together on the debate camps prepping Ed Miliband, and we were all pretty surprised. We thought the big moment would be Boris Johnson doing an absolutely huge scripted dump on Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, and actually in advance they were putting out these sort of little videos, and it was Boris Johnson prepping for the debate with literally with boxing gloves on, with Get Brexit yeah. Done written on them. And so you sort of felt that there was a knockout punch coming, and it never really came.
And I think that that's what I think all the strategists will be gearing up. Because I was looking back through the last debates that we prepared for in 2015, actually the standout moments were when politicians did have the sort of bravery to really attack another politician. Actually, quite a lot of that came from the women that were involved in the debate. Leanne Wood famously attacked Nigel Farage very vigorously on his words on immigration. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon was very, very brutal against Ed Miliband in terms of austerity light. So they tend to be the standout moments. And I think come the next debate, both men are going to have to be less defensive and more offensive.
It did strike me Boris was being very careful that that question at the end, which was kind of what would you give the other person as a Christmas present.
That was awful.
I slightly sensed there were about five funny but outrageous answers going through his head, all of which he was rejecting out of hand. You could see the wheels sort of turning, and you know, in the end he said, oh, a copy of my Brexit deal, and you know,
that was
sort
of really cringe. Groaned, actually, that was a groan-a-thon moment. It's just like, oh come on. I did actually think the handshake was a really awful cringe moment as well, because it was so artificial.
It didn't work.
Well, no one believes it.
Paul, do you worry at all about your party and its relationship with the truth? All parties do this a bit during election campaigns.
Are we talking about social media?
Well, yes, that's the fact check thing. It seemed to me to fit a wider pattern. You know, Jeremy Corbyn's going to cost us 1.2 trillion quid.
Looking at what people laughed at, and they laughed at the Prime Minister on the trust thing, I think, you know, is a bit of a concern. I mean, you know, clearly parties always try to maximise their positions during election campaigns. That's nothing new. I don't really understand what was going on with the changing your name of your Twitter account to Fact Check UK. So I'm not sure it's a worthwhile row. I don't claim to understand the strategy behind it. Maybe there's something far too clever for me.
Would Theresa May have been more restrained about some of this stuff, do you think? Was she more cautious about telling the truth?
I mean, the implication of that question is dangerous.
True. but you know what I'm saying? It strikes me she's instinctively a more cautious politician.
I think, look, she was a stickler for detail. That was very much part of her tenure as Prime Minister, and it's the way she approached her job as Home Secretary. There are clearly differences between her and her successor. It's probably not helpful if I say too much more than that.
Well, allow me to step in. I mean, the contrast couldn't be clear. I mean, as much as everyone, you know, had their critique about Theresa May, I mean, she was at least somebody who you might have thought she was really boring and, you know, dull as dishwater. But, you know, you kind of thought if she said something, it sort of got some heft to it. It's got some sort of truth. We do have a prime minister and an operation right now, which is kind of really famed for its lack of honesty and the lack of trust, which we saw in the fact that people spontaneously burst out laughing.
Yeah, I don't think they'd have laughed at Theresa May if she'd said that.
No, I agree. And I think the Conservative Party have got to be really, really careful on this, because there's this sort of meta message about the Conservative Party now, which is, can you trust them? And that does seem to be...
Yeah, you think of Philip Hammond, don't you, now on the scrap heap?
Yeah. Yeah,
or rather, popping up on a board near you, no doubt. Will, does this sort of stuff matter to voters, this perception of kind of trust or lack thereof?
I think there's short-term and long-term issues here. I think it may be in the Conservative Party's interest to have some of these, you know, clever social media campaigns and so forth. And there's been a lot of talk of, you know, dead cat strategies and this kind of, you know, dominating the social media agenda. I'm a little bit sceptical of those. But I think there are long-term, really pernicious consequences of, you know, a kind of lack of integrity and, you know, a kind of lack of transparency in politics. I mean, you know, historically, voters are more distrustful of politicians than ever. They're incredibly cynical. And I think on one level, we can say, oh, that's just part of the dirty business of politics. Well, you know, voters haven't always been cynical about politics. Actually, you look back to kind of the post-war kind of election campaigns in the 40s and 50s, voters didn't think that, you know, politicians were angels, but they did think they could be good people. And I think politicians have to start recognising that the more cynical the public are, the more difficult it is actually to win them over in the long run. So they might vote for Boris Johnson this time, but in 5 years' time, it might actually be far more difficult to convince those people to come out vote for you again. And it's actually just more difficult to govern. I think in a context where, you know, we need to trust governments to act in our interest and politicians to act in our interests, for governments to actually function in terms of delivering good policies, good public services. And so I think, you know, we are living in an age where technology means that it's very easy to get quick wins, to be kind of incredibly ingenious with your social media strategies. But some of these effects are going to have really kind of corrosive impacts on society and the way we do politics, that just makes your supporters far more volatile, far less reliable and fickle.
Right, we'll leave it there for now. After the break, my colleague Peter Walker talks us through the Green Party's manifesto, and the panel and I will speculate on what we can expect from those that are still to come. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, the Green Party was the first out of the blocks when it came to publishing their election manifesto. Before the launch, the party had already announced it planned to spend £100 billion a year to tackle the climate crisis. They said they'd raise this money through borrowing and increasing corporation tax, among other things. Yesterday, at the picturesque London Wetlands Centre, the party launched what they described as a radical and transformative manifesto. My colleague Peter Walker travelled to southwest London to learn of their plan in full and talked to one of their co-leaders, Sean Berry.
10 bills proposed by Green MPs. For a Green New Deal, a people's vote, NHS reinstatement, a further and higher education bill, a sustainable economy bill, a future generations bill. A bill to introduce universal basic income. A bill to build 100,000 new council homes a year, a renters' rights bill, and of course, a voting reform bill to give us a real democracy at last. Greens will tackle the climate crisis. Greens will remain and transform. Greens will build a better Britain. This is the last election where we can take the first step down the right path, and that is what we must do. Vote Green. If not now, when?
So this is quite an ambitious election for the Greens. They're standing at what they say is a record number of seats. The problem for the Greens always is the electoral system doesn't really favour them. So at the European elections, which is a proportional representation system, they got about 12% of the vote. And they were doing quite well a few months ago. They won about 6 or 7%. But now they seem to be being squeezed a little bit by the major parties. The current poll of polls has them at about 3%, which is not really much better than they did at the last general election. So they're really going to have to hope this manifesto launch, and particularly the focus on, you know, the climate emergency, which lots of people are talking about, gets them back into the news and helps them creep up again. So I'm with Sian Berry, the co-leader of the Greens, who's just given her manifesto launch speech. And you know, this is quite an exciting election for the Greens, isn't it? Because, you know, a lot of the stuff which you've been talking about for years is really, really in the news.
It is, and I think with Brexit as well, you know, we are making very big decisions as a country. There are decisions we have to make that we've put off for too long, and so they've become bigger decisions, getting a lot of grief about our spending plans, but our spending plans are what's necessary to tackle the climate emergency. If we started 20 years ago, we could be spending a lot less per year on transforming, because we've transformed quite a lot already. And I think it does open the door to people listening to things that are, you know, maybe sound quite radical, but actually are very much needed, so yeah.
And it looks quite likely that you're going to be the only major party going into this election with this zero carbon emissions by 2030 target, because, you know, Labour obviously passed this motion, but it looks very much like they're going to row back from that. Does that disappoint you?
Labour members, within the Labour Party, fought incredibly hard to get that 2030 target into policy at the conference. You know, I watched that happen. It was. We were all on tenterhooks, and it's very disappointing to see them so easily row back on it, because it isn't something we should duck out of lightly.
As a party, you've kind of successfully got the message across. You're not just about environmental issues, also about kind of inequality, economics, and stuff like that. But some of your ideas on that are kind of being slightly borrowed by other parties, like the idea of the four-day week, and other people looking at universal basic income. Is that almost like a kind of worry that your success will end up being just influencing other parties?
This is why we're putting forwards these 10 bills. We're not expecting to be the government. We're expecting to be an important influence on whoever's in government. So the more people take up our ideas, piece by piece, the better they move, the more they move in our direction, the more we'll push them even further. That's what we've seen in London, for example. So we're there. That's the role we can play in Parliament as well, holding all the parties to account, being pleased when they take up our ideas and making sure they do them properly and pushing them even further. That's our job. That's what it's always been.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a week of manifesto launches. Yours is the first one. And being the kind of smallest party of that group and also being first, how do you kind of keep it in the news? How do you stop it being lost?
All the way through this election, we've been setting the agenda. We've been saying this should be the climate election. Voters are saying they agree with us. Other parties are playing catch up on our targets and on our measures that we put forwards right at the beginning of this election. By coming forwards with our full manifesto now, that's a challenge to the other parties. We're setting the agenda again. It'll be interesting to see how they respond. I hope lots of them are taking notes and making hurried changes to their manifestos today, straight away, as soon as they've seen what we've got here.
I thought the launch was really interesting. They're an increasingly professional party, and the message was very, very clear. They had this press release that went out overnight with these 10 bills, which they want to get across. And they're trying to move their focus away from just being the environmental party. They're very, very big on economic areas, which some other parties are starting to pick up on. For example, the idea of the universal basic income and the four-day week. And they chime quite well with this kind of disaffection that Labour have also picked up on the massive economic inequalities. I mean, this is the start of a week of manifesto launches. You've got the Lib Dems tomorrow, you've got Labour on Thursday, the Conservatives probably next week. And there's going to be a lot of policies floating around. And to an extent, I quite like the idea of what Sian said, that, you know, we've set the ground. We've said, you know, this is what needs to be done. They have got the electoral system against them. You know, for example, in the vast majority of seats, you know, they're going to be strongly Labour or strongly Tory, and the Green vote won't make any difference. So they are partly dependent on somehow proportional representation getting in at some point. This could be like 2017, where the two big parties squeeze everyone else out. It could be like 2015, where it kind of atomises a bit. And the Greens are going to hope for the latter, and they're just going to keep on pushing.
This is the climate election! This is the climate election!
Once more we're feeling, this is
the climate election!
Give yourselves a round of applause, everybody!
Political correspondent Peter Walker there. So, well, one of the ways that Labour managed to do well in 2017 was it suppressed the vote quite well, didn't it, of the minor parties, including the Greens. So Jeremy Corbyn, quite left-wing, very, very environmentally focused, and the Greens' vote was somewhat depressed. Can the Greens get back in the game 2019?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen actually in polling for the last 6 months, the Greens doing quite well. I mean, the big issue in Britain's electoral system, right? So the first past the post system is that, you know, and this is for both parties, happens with the Brexit Party and the Conservatives, Labour and the Greens, is that you might be someone who is sympathetic to the Greens, you like their policies, but if you're in a constituency where, you know, there are two parties in contention, do you vote for the Greens or do you lend your vote to Labour? And so I think, you know, one of the things that everyone is expecting about this election campaign was that Labour will pick up some of those votes, people who have been kind of, you know, flirting with the Greens or the Lib Dems, but in their constituency, they'll go back. And that's why we've had a lot of focus on tactical voting. Now, it's true. I think compared to 2017, not all of those people may go to Labour this time. I think we have a tendency to fight the last war. And so I think everyone was thinking, oh, there's going to be another, you know, Corbyn surge. Well, I don't think we should assume that. But I think a lot of Green voters will be cross-pressured, wanting to vote for the kind of Green manifesto with a kind of, you know, kind of incredible detail on environmental matters. But Labour are pushing environmental issues. You know, they're kind of attacking the Conservatives on fracking or, you know, and so forth. So I think a lot of Green voters have a lot in common with the kind of broader social programme of Labour. And so I think some of those voters will go back, but it may just depend on the constituency in question.
Actually, we've had an awful lot of policy already, haven't we? We haven't seen the manifestos yet, but as you say, we've had a string of announcements, Labour on broadband, the Conservatives on crime and other issues. How much does the policy actually matter, do you think, in these campaigns?
Well, I mean, in 2017, it was often said that the leaking of the Labour manifesto was actually, you know, a huge bonus for the Labour Party. And the manifesto was actually seen as one of the stars of the campaign. People really, really liked the Labour manifesto because, you know, for years we had struggled as campaigners on the doorstep with really woolly policies and random vacuous phrases like, what are you offering us? A future fair for all?
Hey.
Kind of way. Whereas there were kind of crunchy retail offers in the last manifesto, you know, any campaigner could go on the doorstep and say, hey, here's the three things we're offering. And of course, tuition fees was the sort of flagship policy at the centre of all of that. And so I think Labour have felt that that worked well for them. So they're really, really doubling down on this. They know that this is their best opportunity. This is really the last opportunity they have to throw kind of full fat Corbynism, Corbyn economics, you know, high spend, transform society through the green industrial revolution, transform, you know, capitalism, all these sort of big ticket things. I mean, they're trying to do a lot in kind of one term. So much has come out already. You think, well, what can there be left? I mean, is there any money left? Like, what can be left? But I'm told that there are still, you know, quite a few big, big things that are in reserve, which are going to be pretty box office. And the question is for the Labour Party is, yes, people will like it because who doesn't like free stuff? But will they believe it? And do they think that this huge plan for radicalism can actually work? Will it thrill them or will it terrify them?
Yeah. Paul, do you think we'll get more grabby offers from the Conservatives this time around? As I say, there weren't many sort of lollies for the voters in 2017, if I remember rightly.
No, not quite. Corbyn, I think, captured the mood last time, didn't he, in a way that we probably underestimated the impact of austerity on the political environment. This time, I don't know, I was quite struck by Prime Minister saying last night that there would be something on social care in the manifesto because...
Brave.
Very brave. Lived through that last time. But, you know, there will be more policies to come. I mean, they've not been shy in the campaign so far, and that probably does indicate that there's more up his sleeve.
And well, manifestos weren't supposed to matter, were they? And then they did.
Well, I mean, I think they matter in two ways. They matter in terms of impacting the media agenda and what we talk about on a daily basis. And actually, funnily enough, I think the thing with the leak is, you know, in some ways you wonder, well, maybe you should leak your own manifesto to kind of get some of it out there in advance. So actually,
well, the conspiracy theory always was that they had, wasn't it? Well, but I'm not quite sure that was true.
No, but you could see why, because if it's a leak, then it's more exciting than this kind of this boring long document that actually most voters don't read. But we read them, and I think that's where it really translates. You know, on the flip side, you know, the parties are looking to avoid duds or things that actually are kind of, you know, gaffes, right? But what the opponents will be looking for are, you know, what's wrong in here that we can pull apart? And so that was the kind of social care issue. I almost felt sorry for the Conservatives in 2017 with social care, because I think it's a huge policy issue that we face. And I think, you know, as a society, you know, obviously an election wasn't the place to have that discussion, but I actually think it was a party saying we've got a big issue, we need to do something about it. But actually that doesn't play out in election manifestos. And so what both parties will be looking for is, what's the thing in here that we can pull apart that, you know, really put them through the grill for and say that we told you so to voters?
Although I do think we're in a slightly different environment, because I think the really detailed scrutiny of all costings and spending, I think that's kind of been ripped up in a post-Brexit environment.
It's been ripped up by Sajid Javid to some extent.
Well, exactly. I mean, having criticised the Labour Party for the magic money tree, they seem to find themselves, you know, their own faraway fiscal forest in terms of sort of spending. So those old orthodoxies, I mean, ironically, the Liberal Democrats are putting forward a sort of, you know, plan which probably most Conservatives would sort of agree with. And I think as well, the voters are becoming slightly desensitised to the sheer numbers that are being, you know, bandied around. You know, millions have turned into billions, which are about to turn into squillions. And, you know, I do think that narrative, I was speaking to somebody from the IFS a couple of days ago, and they were saying, of course, you know, the experts will carry on doing all the fact checking and saying, oh, this is unsustainable in terms of all of the spending. But in a way, you know, thanks to Michael Gove, we are in an environment where people are really sniffy about the experts on spending. It makes it quite hard to attack the other on fiscal competence when you are off to the wacky races yourself in your own sort of spending plans.
It does feel a little bit to me like we might be in the kind of last hurrah of this phase, though. I almost feel this is the last election where the party's going to be able to offer these kind of grand visions with limitless spending. And I would imagine the next election, where we may have to face up to some of the long-term consequences of Brexit, assuming it happens, and everything that comes next, we may actually have to a much tougher election campaign around costing. So it's kind of interesting that the parties are just kind of going for it and then worrying about what we have in the future.
You think the deficit might be back? We should talk about the Liberal Democrats. We've hardly mentioned them. This was going to be a general election where they sort of broke through. They have this very, very strong Brexit message. They're also launching their manifesto today, and they'll be looking to show that they've got other domestic policies, won't they, aside from just wanting to stop Brexit?
I think the Liberal Democrats have had quite a bad campaign, actually. I think they went in with a lot of promise, and I think a couple of things have happened. I think Jo Swinson has just not proved to be as impressive as people wanted her to be. She's not cutting through brilliantly, and in fact there's stuff out this week that says the more people see of her, the less they like her. Secondly, they just seem to have one message, which is Brexit. Now, of course, if you're an ardent Remainer, that is fantastic, but the intelligence, like I said, I'm picking up even from, you know, very strong Remain areas, is that's not the only show in town. It's very hard for them to get cut through on domestic issues, because they don't really seem, or they're not seen to have a strong hinterland. It's not like Jo Swinson has been at the barricades shouting about anti-austerity for the last sort of couple of years, or at the vanguard of reforming education after the tuition fees debacle. But I think the other thing, it goes back to the trust thing we were talking about. Jo Swinson, in my view, should have defined, and has been trying to define herself, as the alternative to Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, these two awful men who she says are not fit to government. You can't trust a word they say. They're thoroughly bad people. She's basically saying to the public, trust me, right? Trust me, I'm a good, honest person. Yet she is then saying the most ludicrous claim that we've all heard, I am going to be the next Prime Minister. And that just doesn't pass the smell test with people. There's more chance of me winning America's Next Top Model, to be quite frank. I don't need to laugh that much at that. I do think people would have a bit more respect for the Liberal Democrats right now if they were just a bit honest and said, look, I'm not going to be the Prime Minister, but I could help decide who is going to be the next Prime Minister. And we're going to have an incredibly important role at being a restraining force and bringing some sanity to what could be quite a bonkers parliament, because you're going to have extreme MPs coming in, or MPs way more to the left, MPs way more to the right. So I think they have mangled their message in too much hubris at a time when people were looking for actually a bit of refreshing honesty about the situation.
Paul, a lot of the seats they're trying to target are Conservative seats, aren't they? Conservative Remain seats. Yeah. For example, some of those held by the MPs who've drifted away because they lost the whip and aren't standing again, and so on. Do you think there's a certain kind of sort of socially liberal, perhaps Remainy Conservative to whom the Lib Dem message might appeal?
Well, I think certainly one of the proxies for success or failure in this election campaign for the Tories will be how well the Lib Dems do. And, you know, if the Lib Dem vote holds up, then I think the Tories will be quite happy with that. I think if it doesn't, then there'll be a certain amount of bother. So the issue with the Lib Dems is that their Brexit position is really, really hard over. So, you know, some people do think that Brexit is a disaster and would just, you know, write a letter or send an email, I think Jo Swinson said, and stop it. But, you know, that is not a position that can command a majority of people in this country. Most people don't think that. So let's see what happens. But, you know, I think the issue about sort of the, you know, we could be the kingmakers, or we could play a role in keeping people honest in the next parliament, is that the history of the Lib Dems is very damaged by their role in the coalition. So it's hard to say at this point in the electoral cycle, and, you know, 22 days out from an election, do you know what? We are going to prop up another party again. I think that probably harms their electoral prospects too much in the short term.
And just one more thing, actually, you were involved in that Miliband campaign where the framing of it was very much, you know, the old coalition of chaos. The Tories are quite hard to land that this time, haven't they? They've talked about Jeremy Corbyn doing a deal with Nicola Sturgeon, perhaps allowing an independence referendum. How important do you think that argument is going to be?
Well, I think it's not going to be quite as toxic as it was in 2015. That actually killed us in the end. We were doing pretty well, and we were on course not to get a majority, but we could have been had the largest number of seats. But those posters that came out actually after those leaders' debates as well were absolutely wounding for us. But I think we're in quite a different climate now, which is a lot of people who may consider voting for Jeremy Corbyn now don't think it's that terrifying to have anything to do with Nicola Sturgeon. In fact, Nicola Sturgeon has become quite a heroic figure amongst sort of progressives because of her stance on Brexit and other things. So I've actually been picking up a lot of people saying, I want there to be some, in fact, it would encourage me to vote Labour.
Bring on the coalition of chaos.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, there's so many people saying I would absolutely love some kind of, you know, thing. Also, Jeremy Corbyn's wording was really interesting because he said wouldn't have a referendum at the early part of any government. So he didn't rule out later on. And for all the hue and cry from Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP, and I spend a lot of time up in Scotland, it's not in the SNP's interest to rush into having a very early referendum. They'll get one crack at another second referendum. The polls are closing, but, you know, independence is not roaring ahead in the polls. People in Scotland definitely are talking about independence a lot now, but the issues that Brexit have thrown up, yes, that's been thrown up about Scottish independence. The emotional argument for Scottish independence is much higher than it's ever been, including amongst people who were unionists in 2014. So it might actually suit Nicola Sturgeon to be kind of do lots of faux outrage about how she wants a referendum now, but actually play the long game a bit, because she knows she's got no chance of ever having another set referendum under a Conservative government. She might get a referendum under some Labour coalition, but it might be 3-4 years down the track, which might actually suit them.
I actually think it may have, you know, some sort of cut through, but nothing like in 2015. And I do actually think the sort of uncertainty and chaos that we've seen ever since the referendum actually really underplays that, because a lot of people say, well, you know, it's not been particularly strong and stable since 2015. So, you know, what are you really getting me to vote for? So I'm not sure it's quite as convincing a message. I think it can play into people's perceptions of, you know, Corbyn being kind of, you know, in hock to the kind of the SNP. But I don't think it's as powerful. You know, I think, you know, Johnson's still trying it because it's going to seem like a good attack line, but I don't think it's going to be quite as powerful as 2015.
It's interesting because I suppose, you know, I personally come from the sort of political tradition where I do think that is something that is, if not toxic, semi-toxic. But it interests me a lot how forward-leaning Corbyn chose to be in his language. So the fact that he's not ruling it out in the course of a parliament and very conspicuously being seen to do so is interesting. And it's either kind of quite smart and will seem to be vindicated, or will be one of the reasons he didn't do as well as he wanted to.
3 weeks to go. We will see. Thank you all very much. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Aisha Hazarika, Paul Harrison, Will Jennings, Rowena Mason and Peter Walker. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.